Hey folks, hope you're well. This is Jim Carroll saying hello and welcome you to the latest Bantercast, the weekly podcast from the team behind the Banter series of talks and events. At Banter, we put on events in spaces and venues up and down the country. They can be tents, they can be rooms, they can be in the open air. And there we invite various people to come along and tell stories, talk about their lives and discuss various topics and themes. We record what happens in the room on the night and then we podcast the results. This week we're back in Dingle County, Kerry as part of the Other Voices Festival. Every December we head there, we basically take over a room in Foxy John's and we invite some people to come along and tell stories. One of the people who came along in 2016 was Yvonne McNamara. She is the Donegal-born firebrand behind Galway restaurant Arbia and the Tweed Project. She had a lot to say about basically food, fashion and basically living an interesting life. And here's what she has to say. Hi folks, welcome back to Banter here at Foxy John's. Hope you're all comfortable. So, from rugby and the Beatles and the Stones in the 1960s to this amazing woman. Her name is Yvonne McNamara. She's got a background in art, who accidentally got involved in the food business and now runs Arbia in Galway and the Tweed Project. Please give her a big warm round of applause. Welcome to Banter and Foxy John's.
Great to be here.
How are you?
I'm good. Great weekend. Just first time in Dingle for Other Voices, so it's amazing, you know. Yeah. It's an amazing small-time vibe and really exciting.
Yeah. Do you think the idea of kind of something like Other Voices in a small, out of season kind of seaside town is something we should be doing a lot more of in this country?
Yeah, I suppose, you know, obviously I think about Drop Everything and, you know, that whole kind of small accessibility around, you know, a small location I think is beautiful. And I was at the Edge Conference, the Ireland Edge Conference just this morning, which was very difficult to focus because, you know, of the beauty outside the window. You know, there was a lot of talk about kind of regional development and making stuff happen in Donegal and Kerry as opposed to this kind of, you know, city centre focus, which, you know, isn't so good. So I think the more of this, the better, because I think we need to be pulled out of our cities, engage more with nature and get to meet each other in a real context, you know.
It's kind of weird, because, I mean, like, it's definitely changed. I mean, you grew up in Donegal, you know, and I know from interviews you've done in the past, you know, you were reading Elle magazine. You were thinking quite a lot about getting the heck out of Donegal as well.
Well, in Donegal, I had nothing, like nothing. It was, you know, remarkable. We'd walk the beach once a week and that was literally all it was. I mean, I had no extracurricular activities, nothing provided by the school. But in a sense, I had the most important thing, which is access to unlimited nature in the most extraordinary remote part of the world. But I suppose, you know, bringing up a child myself, I actually think that less is more in the context of childhood. And so I was frustrated, I suppose, as a teenager and as a child that I wasn't getting access to stuff because I could feel that I needed more than what I was being given. But I mean, through that, then your imagination grows, you know. Somebody said to me once, boredom is the creative imaginative development of the child. So, in terms of Elle magazine, I got Elle magazine in the local newsagent once a month and I learned about East Saint Laurent and I learned about places like Saint-Tropez and Cancun and all this. And I accessed it through that. Yeah. And it was my education for my adolescent. And there was no discos and there was no anything. So that was my everything, you know. Right.
How many copies of Elle magazine arrived in that newsagent every month?
No, just one. And I don't know why I chose Elle over Vogue. I need to... That's not really good, but anyway.
So, like, I mean, Elle introduced this idea of kind of like all these wonderful places and like everything going on elsewhere. And sometimes, I mean, I remember when I was a kid in Tipperary, it was NME and Melody Maker that kind of fired up my imagination. Mm. And you were kind of going like, okay, I have to get out of here, you know. Mm. And when you decided kind of to do stuff after school then and third level, what did you choose?
So I went to study art history and I wanted to go to Trinity and I didn't get it. But anyway, so I pretended, I went to UCD and I pretended I was going to Trinity for 3 years. And what was your question?
Why you decided on that route?
Oh, so I wanted to study art history because I wasn't really an artist. So I couldn't go to NCAD. So I thought I could you know, read about art, and I could kind of do that. And I think that always it was really important to me then, as it is now, the pursuit of an aesthetic life is my whole motivation. And so I learned about art, and that was one of the steps. And I suppose I started travelling then, and that was another important step. My parents always went to, like, ridiculous places like the Canaries, and I'm like, I could never understand it. So the minute I was in university, I was just travelling all the time, and it was an incredibly important part of my development.
Yeah.
And living with certain people and getting access, you know, listening to Bob Dylan for the first time in a house in Ragging Road and accessing different things that really were not there initially. They were never there. So I would have encountered Bob Dylan only when I was like 20, because, you know, there was nothing.
I said during that phase, Bob Dylan wasn't written about in Elle magazine quite a lot.
No, but I didn't. I didn't buy records, and I couldn't buy records. And anyway, so I was very limited. So, but then it was all beautiful, the whole process of exploring these things and finding them initially, you know.
Yeah. You said there, like, you did a lot of travelling. Where was the first kind of place that really made an impact on you in terms of what it was about?
Well, I suppose I'm focusing on, I suppose, interrailing times and just that kind of, I was telling my son recently that, you know, we used to go and we used to just say, oh, Vienna, you know, oh, Krakow, oh, and, you know, that amazing thing where, you know, and, oh, jeepers, didn't we know somebody in Florence? Oh, sure, we'll go down there. And I suppose that was the initial thing, and that incredible freedom. But I mean, in terms of places that have influenced me, what influenced me in terms of travel at 20 and 30 and 40 now is quite different. You know, I'm very passionate about kind of Scandinavia right now, very passionate about traveling to the Middle East. So that's where I'm at now.
Okay. So, like, you know, after you did the history of art course, I mean, you did art administration then. So that was like probably the 90s, was it?
Yeah, somebody asked me that the other day. I'm not sure.
Because I remember, like, there was a time in the 90s when the arts administration course was all the rage. Mm. Everyone seemed to do it, you know?
Mm. Yeah, so I did the second year course in NUIG in the arts administration. And I suppose, again, not being an artist, I thought then I'd work in an arts organisation. And I kind of did that in project and, you know, in places in Toronto and stuff like that. And I was always interested in that. I'm not so interested in that now. It's nice how we move on, isn't it?
Yeah, totally, because it's like it always happens. And, like, the next step, I suppose, was like the restaurant you had in Donegal, the cafe you had in Donegal. Mm. Like, what brought you back there? And, like, you know, what was your immersion in food like?
So, well, I was away from Ireland, like everybody is ultimately, and I was living in London and working in Babington House and Soho House in London, and which was really, really important, I think, for my kind of career and my kind of understanding of hospitality. You know, Nick Jones is quite a brilliant man in terms of what he did, and it's still kind of relevant. And so I came back as the kind of Celtic Tiger was happening, and I had this kind of huge kind of, you know, what am I going to do? But I had this moment where I was answering the phone for Nick Jones, who I was very much admired, but I thought I could answer the phone for myself. So I had that kind of moment, which people either have or don't have, and it's perfectly fine. And so I came back, and I wasn't really in the great best of form, and I spent time in a Buddhist center in Cavan with an amazing Tibetan Lama who I cooked there for a month, and it was very, very transformative, you know. And then I had this idea to open a cafe in Donegal, because there was at that time 14 pubs in a population town of about 800, and yet there was nowhere for them to be that didn't involve alcohol. And so I always found that food can transform you. So you give somebody a lovely bowl of soup and some beautiful bread, and it can really transform them in a really essential way. And so I opened it, and it was, you know, €70 a week, and it was very, very beautiful. Like, if it was a sunny day, which it was once, like, in the whole summer, we'd go to the beach. And, you know, the driving rain at Donegal. But it was a lovely place, and there was a little credit union upstairs, and I used to put in X amount of money every week, and don't tell the revenue. And and then suddenly I had the, you know, I had this degree of finance to I didn't want to. So it was only a four month period, and then I'd go off traveling in the winter. And I didn't really want to kind of stop my life and go traveling, and come back and stop my life and go traveling. And so then I moved to Galway.
Okay, before we get on to the Galway years, and before we get on to kind of the move to Galway, you know, you mentioned there Nick Jones and kind of Soho House and Bambi Towns. These are kind of private members' clubs, and he's created this amazing kind of, like, I mean, enterprise around it. Mm. What did you learn from him? I mean, it's obvious from what you're saying, you quite admired how he worked, but it always kind of struck me that he'd be on a different level as to where you're coming from.
Well, no, not at all. Mm. Because, like, Nick Jones is the kind of man that's, you know, I always tell my staff this, you know, back in the day when I was working with him, he'd come round and he'd drive around his four operations in central London to make sure that he could see them from the car, that the lights were at the right level. And he'd be the man picking up the cigarette butts. So, you know, if you really care about your business, you're on the same level. So that's on a basic level in terms of what I learned from him. The other thing I learned from him, and it exists even stronger today than ever, is the sense of cultural community, which he encouraged. I mean, I would have gone to screenings in Soho House with Bernard Bertolucci, and, you know, and I would have, you know, had access to, which I would never have had before, you know, all the Lars von Trier series, and they would be shown, and then I would have access to Michael Winterbottom, and they would be there, and you know, incredible events around film particularly, that would have been an amazing education for me, and this sense of connection. I mean, I was in Soho House in New York, I don't know, Berlin once recently, and you know, the schedule of events that they are undertaking in terms of talks are next level, like. So if you ever have an opportunity to go in and access any of these events that are on right now, they're incredible. I mean, they're kind of like, in a sense, you know, the next way of thinking or the next kind of thought pattern. Very progressive. So, you know, obviously he's got the whole of the creative community, global creative community in, you know, Istanbul, Miami, la la la, and, you know, elitist or whatever. They're interconnecting with each other.
Yeah.
But so I think it's a lovely model. I think it's a brilliant model, and I think he's made it very successful, you know.
Has he approached you about doing a kind of a Soho House Galway?
No, I'm not in touch with Nick, but I mean, I don't want to do a Soho House Galway, because a friend of mine did an event recently in Berlin last weekend, and she was talking about inclusivity as opposed to exclusivity, and I think that's a beautiful concept. So, you know, he was of a time for me, but maybe not now, you know. Right.
So anyway, so you've your money saved in the credit union upstairs, and like you're looking around, and what drew you to Galway?
So I went down to visit my friend, and the classic Galway story, which everybody who lives in Galway has, they're either from Galway or they have this crazy random story like I'm about to tell you, which is the reason why they end up in Galway for like 15 years, and then they go away and then they come back and they regret going away for those period. But anyway, so I was sitting outside Nocton's, and I hadn't been in Galway since I did the postgrad, so it might be, I don't know, 5-6 years. Yeah. And I was sitting in the pub outside Nocton's, I said that. Anyway, and Woody Harrelson is sitting beside us, and I'm like, this is unbelievable. Like, you know, of course it's not that unbelievable, but like, I was like, I got to move to Galway. So I literally... I literally packed up and got the little place around the corner, hoping maybe that Woody Harrelson would come and sit there. But anyway, so that's my Galway story. But you know, and I adore Galway. I just adore Galway.
Well, what do you adore about it? I mean, like every single person that you say who's moved to Galway would give a different answer to that. So what's what's the Yvonne McNamara answer to that?
Well, you know, yesterday now I was in the sea and I was cycling back, and I was feeling this, you know, it was around 9:30 whatever, and I was cycling back and I was like, my heart was literally breaking for the missing. So, you know, the beauty of it, you know, and I was like slightly comforted by the fact that I was going to be in Dingle for the weekend, but you know, only slightly. But so I don't know, I think it's a very small town, it's very accessible, it doesn't impose a lot on you. You know, I go to Dublin and I feel kind of, oh, I need to be doing this, or I need to be getting this, or I need to be... There's nothing to buy in Galway. You know, nothing to buy unless you want an Erin jumper, and which is kind of lovely in a way. And then we've got, like, such an incredible food community, you know, and I'm all about the food. So, you know, and we have a lovely community of supporters. So, you know, oh my God, have you been to Kai? And oh my God, have you gone to the new Universal? And, you know, and then we're on the front line with tourists who are really loving it, you know. So, you know, I think it's a magical place. I think that those that live there know how magical it is. And I think, you know, relating back to the Ireland Edge conference there, this kind of, you know, beyond the pale, oh, you know, as a creative, I won't really make it happen, or it's not going to give me the same thing. But I think we need to get the life work balance thing better. And you know, I have friends moving over from London, and I'm so happy, and it's my like mission to get people over from London. Like, it's like, oh please, like, so, because you know, they're not happy, they're not happy, and they could be happy. Yeah. And also, yeah, you know, that would be reinvigorating Galway. I mean, you know, I think Galway could do with a really good graphic designer, for example. So if anyone wants to move to Galway, we've got that, you know, we've got that covered for you. So you know, there are obviously some good graphic designers, but you know, but you know, so I think, you know, especially when people are having children and they're thinking, you know, and you know, all that.
Someone spoke yesterday, and I'm really sorry, I can't remember her name. She spoke at the Creative Edge or the Ireland's Edge conference, and she moved to Silicon Valley with her husband and I think four or five kids. Mm. And she was praising, what's her name?
Brendan
Romero. She was praising Galway's education to the skies, way better than...
So she
moved to Galway. Mm-hmm. And like, it's interesting, I had a discussion with someone last night about this, and maybe it's a case that we don't actually appreciate what we've got around us.
Mm-hmm. Well, in terms of education, you know, my son is across the road is in an incredible Irish school, a jazz school, and it's just phenomenal. But all of our schools are free education in Galway, and I mean, and the same isn't true in Dublin. And you know, it's a very difficult road, that, and it's also suddenly propels your child straight away to be in a kind of a socio-economic grouping, which I think is a terrible thing. And I think it's wonderful, this kind of, you know, that children can just go to schools, and it's just part of the framework, you know.
Okay.
So yeah, I mean, it's a beautiful structure around education as well, and in terms of things that can access, like sailing clubs and all of this amazing, you know, the waterways and all the lifestyle that a child can be involved in. So you know, it's incredible.
Okay, so you met Woody, and Woody,
I
basically
didn't actually.
Well, you sat beside.
Yeah, yeah.
So Woody inspired you then to kind of move to Galway. Like when you set up that cafe, that wasn't R&B at Nemo's. That was somewhere else, was it?
So that was R&B beside Nocton's,
the
tiny place.
Yeah.
And you know, and then thankfully, you know, busy, and then I was like, okay, well then we'll do all the food for Nocton's, and then busy, and then we'll move above Nocton's. Oh yeah. Busy. and then we're like, okay, down the road now to Nemo's.
Nemo's has some reputation. I mean, I remember when I go to Galway for the Arts Festival back in the day, that was, you'd always go there to eat. It had a great reputation. When you took it over, I mean, were you aware of Harriet's?
I want to tell you one thing now. I was fired from working in Nemo's when I was in college.
Right. Okay. That didn't come out in the research.
No.
What'd you get fired for?
Well, it wasn't so much fired as this kind of, you know, phasing her off the rota tactic. So basically, I had five shifts, and then three shifts, and then I was like, I'm not waiting for the following week.
Would you be a hard person to employ?
What?
Would you be a hard person to employ?
Oh, no.
Would you employ
yourself? No,
you're allowed to pass on one question.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's fine. Maybe I'm not so employable now, you know, but I can work hard.
Okay,
yeah, yeah.
So let's leave your employability alone, because no one here is going to employ you for a start, because you haven't got the time.
No.
But like, so say taking over Nemo's then, you know, like was that a big stretch financially, or what was involved in that?
Well, it was, you know, again, it was responding to the incredible busyness and also trying to secure my business for the next 35 years. So and buying a lease that will, you know, be a, you know, basically. Will retain my business. But we hit the recession then at that time, and I can't say that it was easy at all. I don't think the recession was easy for anybody in Ireland. So it was a very, very difficult time financially. So, but now it's amazing, and we've come through it. And I think anyone who's come through the recession and succeeded through the recession is... is better because of it, and grateful for every day that we can trade and that we can pay our staff and feed our customers, you know.
Mm, okay, so like the thing is, you've said before that, like, I mean, your involvement in food is quite accidental, you know.
Mm.
And like, I mean, like, anytime I eat an RP, it's amazing. The food's incredible, you know. Mm. And like, for something that's accidental, it's you can see your passion and, like, I mean, your kind of like integrity coming out in it. Mm. How important is it for you, you know, that you're able to kind of, I suppose, going back to that Nick Jones thing, him going around seeing all these different, he's different enterprises and making sure everything's right. How important is it for you to make sure that, like, Ardbeia hits the same standard every time? You won't be in Galway tonight, for example. So, like, if the person you've hired to look after the place, you know, I remember walking in there before, you'd Mary Nally in charge of the place. I mean, Jesus Christ, you know? Like, so, like, how important is it for you to make sure the person you've got is right?
Yeah.
Sorry, Mary.
Well, I mean, you know, I have an incredible team. I have an incredible manager, Amelia, and, you know, she's beyond phenomenal, and I have amazing, you know, amazing head chef, and I have an amazing team who I respect and they respect me. And so, you know, I think it's that balance that you need to get right in order for it to be successful. And if you're not there and it's not good, then there's not really much point, because then you have no life freedom. And I don't know. I'm very lucky that that balance has been able to happen. But, I mean, that's very much down to Amelia and managing people respectfully.
But, you know. Yeah, you mentioned respect there. And obviously the people can do the job as well. But is there something else you look for in the people? You know, because, I mean, is there an instinct? If you're hiring people for your tech, I mean, I know, for, like, there's big companies, like the bigger tech companies who are based here have long interviewing processes. Mm. I think Facebook interviews someone 9 or 10 times before they hire the person. Mm. I mean, if you meet someone, do you know instantly, like, if they're going to click or instantly going to work?
Well, I used to be allowed to hire, and now I'm not allowed to hire. Very seldom am I allowed to hire. I went out on a boat recently with a gorgeous guy. He must have been about 18, and at the end of rowing me out, he said, "Could I get a job in RB?" And I'm like, "Yes, yes, yes!" and thankfully, he was successful. But normally, I'm not as good as Amelia now. Amelia would be very good. I would be like, some guy came in about 2 years ago, and his surname was Darling, and I was like, "Oh, we have to hire him." and he was a disaster. A lovely person, but a disaster. So I would be like into the crack, and Amelia is not as much into the crack. But she's still a lot of fun. But she's amazing. But you know, so no, I don't hire anymore.
Okay, let's move on then to the other project that you're involved in, which is a Tweed project. You know, I mean, you grew up in Donegal Village, where there was a kind of like a Tweed was an industry there as well, wasn't it, in that town? So was that part of the reason why you got involved with that, or was it just down to the collaboration?
Well, it is an industry in the town, Jim, but it wasn't really an industry. It was an industry, like, there was you know, John Malloy, who his grandson and son is who we're working with now, that very old producer of knitwear and tweed, was still producing, and there was at least 7 or 8 operations producing their Bonners jumpers and Kennedys of Ardra and all of that, and they're all friends of mine. But but a bit like the cafe, I with all due respect, I was. Would have loved for them to be doing it in a slightly more contemporary way. Now, not Malloy and Son. I mean, they had an incredible vision for what they were producing, and it was very contemporary. And, you know, meeting Kieran was an amazing thing. And I was very motivated by the fact that we were his only client back then, 2.5 years ago, in Ireland. So I was like, whoo! And so that was a motivation for me. So I mean, I knit myself. I'm really passionate about knitwear and tweed, and I'm passionate about everything that is, you know, truly Irish. I just wished it was being done a little bit more contemporary, and so that's why we set up the Tweed project.
When you set it up, 7-3, and set it up, you know, did you know who was going to be buying this? Did you know there was an audience out there for it?
Well, we are very selfish about how we design. We design for ourselves, and to hell with the rest of them. So we design what we like, and thankfully people like it, but we're like, oh, sure, look, we'll get a jumper and put on the tassels, and then, you know, and sure, listen, if nobody likes it, we'll wear it, and but people do like it, so we're happy, you know.
Where do you sell the pieces?
So we're in the Marvel Room now in Brown Thomas in Dublin, and we're with Makers and Brothers in their pop-up shop, and we sell a lot through the restaurant. So you come in for the steak dinner and you go out with the scarf, and we sell from the showroom in the in my house where we produce everything in Galway. So we, you know, it's very difficult to sell through third parties. Anyone in the fashion industry knows you just make no money. So
yeah.
So we try to, you know, keep it online or through ourselves, because, you know, and that's why we have a lovely relationship with Brown Thomas, where they're doing not doing that 50%. So that makes it, you know, makes it so that it's viable for us, and it's really good for them as well.
Right. I mean, like, have you thought about, like, you know, I suppose you're talking there about, like, very much keeping it in Galway, you know, doing things like that.
Mm.
Obviously, you're not haven't immersed or haven't got involved in kind of like the volume end of things. I mean, do you think that would kill you off?
Well, no, we produce everything pretty much to order. So, you know, so we're very much about slow fashion. Like, you know, we don't want to produce 20 pants in the hope that somebody's going to buy them. We're producing for you, and so, you know, there is no waste, and that's really important to us. And this kind of mass production, it's not something I want to get involved with, and having to produce 50 pieces and all of that. It's a very beautiful, slow, organic process, and we don't want it to change. I mean, we'd like our turnover to improve slightly so that we can be more creative and have the freedom to do that, but, you know, we're quite happy with where it is now.
Mm, okay. There's a quote you had from an interview that I opened this up just to remember it, and it was you were talking about, like, me, that before RBA my career hadn't kicked in, you know.
Mm.
Did you, like, it's fascinating, kind of like, as you're explaining, like, what you do right now, and, like, I mean, you're very good at kind of like showing this all kind of happenstance, you know, whereas there's no plan behind it or whatever. But I'm really interested, like, before you set up RBA in Galway, before you met Woody and Woody persuaded you to move to Galway, where did you think you were going to end up? Like, what do you think you were going to do?
Well, I had established RBA before Woody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So when RBA happened, I felt for the first time in my life that my life clicked in. So rather than being somebody who made a phone call to make something happen, people were ringing me to make stuff happen. I did a lot of arts related events there and all of that. But, you know, and so it was really nice to become a platform for stuff to happen rather than, you know, waiting for opportunities to come. So, you know, so yeah, life kind of began then, but I was very much in limbo before that. So when I was 27, it all clicked in and it all started to make sense. I'm not saying it was all easy, but it started to make sense, you know, and things aligned in a way. And I don't know, did that answer your question?
That does, yeah, because it brings us to the next question, which is, you mentioned earlier on about, like, the fact that you were still standing after the recession, you know, and the fact you came through that. You were also kind of saying that anyone who came through the recession, you know, like, deserved it, you know, they worked hard at it.
Mm.
Do you think as well that, like, post-recession, that we've, I suppose, reclaimed some of that soul we lost during the mad times? Because, I mean, I'm thinking about when, like, Paul Harvey was talking earlier on about Ross or Carl Kelly. I mean, that's a chronicle of the mad times.
Mm.
And, like, now it seems we've come through the mad times, we've come through the recession, and now we're at the other side.
Mm.
Do you think, you know, that as that happens, that we suddenly kind of a bit more soulful, a bit more respectful of what we're about, and also a bit more kind of, like, I suppose, confident about what Irish identity is about now as well.
Well, I saw it in the restaurant, you know, during the recession. I saw, like, you know, pheasant for €35 and three triple Bailey's coffees and four bottles of Sancerre. I saw the kind of level of kind of insane consumption, you know, and ill health resulting from that. And now I see, you know, very considered kind of, you know, consumption. People are more considered about what they eat and how they consume, which is really important, not just in the restaurant, but in their lives. People are very conscious of, you know, health and well-being now, the people who are lucky enough to be going down that road. And I think there's a big shift in that. We certainly have come back to ourselves, gotten back to the essence of who we are, which is really extraordinary people, people who are engaged with others, and people who, I had a very interesting conversation with John Kilcannon last week about, you know, the essence of who we are, which is, you know, deeply cultural people. And so, yeah, we're getting back to that. And again, with the conference this morning, this kind of awareness of, you know, the potential for us all to map the future of contemporary Ireland, that we all have the potential to be involved in that positive change. I do also think there's a deep underlying malaise in the country, which saddens me, and we can see that through, you know, street drinking, and we have a very, very ongoing suicide problem in Galway, and you know, so that's part of society. But you know, in our essence, you know, we're extraordinary people, and I think it's just to reinvent that and to be aware of that is quite important. You know, don't know if that's the.
I want to touch on what you said there about John Kilcannon, and like, I mean, that deep cultural thing. I mean, that Irish people are quite cultural. You know, do you think, you know, that we're an insular people? Have we become more open to kind of outside influences? Because you travel a lot, and it's very funny. One of my colleagues in the Irish Times learned that I was talking to you. They kind of find, where is she going next? You know, because I mean, you go to Iran, you go to Morocco. You know, you come back with these ideas. So do you think, you know, that Irish people again? This morning at the diaspora panel, that when Blond Healy was talking about like being away and all that, do you think we've become more open here in this country about outside influences and bringing them into what Irishness is all about?
Well, you know, I suppose I can see it through the restaurant. You know, when I established in Quay Street, you know, that you had to kind of do the meat and potato, and then, you know, slowly the tabbouleh comes in and da da da. So yeah, there is an openness for that. I think we are by our nature more in the past than now. Essentially, kind of, you know, kind of insular, but I think we're becoming more and more open. I suppose they spoke about the Polish community, which is an incredibly backbone of our society now, and an extraordinary group of people, and that's incredible. I think, you know, the testament to us having a rally in terms of trying to get more Syrians in here than the quota that the government wants is an example of, you know, that, you know, deep kindness that we have and that awareness of other people and their suffering. I think that, not sure I'm answering, am I?
No, you're answering, I suppose it's more about, like, I mean, like, you know, if we're ready to embrace people who move here, but what about, like, ideas from abroad as well? I mean,
ideas from abroad? Well, I mean, you know, I always believe things don't happen en masse. I think they're small building blocks. And, you know, I a lot of my travels seep into the restaurant, and so I like this notion of people being there and yet, you know, transformed to somewhere else or being somewhere else at the same time as being there. For me, it just moves in kind of by osmosis. But everybody is traveling now, and everybody is bringing back elements of that travel, and it's all very global now. So, and yet we're protected by this cocoon of Irishness, so that, you know, it's always lovely to come back, you know, because I don't think there's any country better than this country, you know, and no people better than this country, for sure.
Right. Last couple of questions for me then. You know, what do you make of kind of the fact that, you know, Galway is going to be under the spotlight for Galway 2020? Are you looking forward to that? Do you think it's a big opportunity for Galway's kind of, like, I suppose, madness to spread even further in Europe?
Yeah, I mean, obviously we were so absolutely thrilled that Limerick didn't win. Because it was 1 point in the difference, actually.
Was that it?
Yeah. But obviously it's an incredible opportunity for Galway, but it's not an easy, it's not an easy thing. I mean, the financial stuff that'll be involved now in the next while, it will be kind of tough for the city council and all that. But I think that, you know, Galway has a lot of attention, but I suppose what I would love to see, and I don't know if it's possible, is kind of more entrenched kind of cultural stuff, because Galway is a series of amazing events. And I think, you know, bringing up a child in Galway, we'd love to see kind of, you know, a really consolidated visual arts space, you know, having the Palace Cinema open, you know, having, you know, we have no art house cinema. It's like unbelievable. So there's all this kind of incredible gap in, you know, in your film education and all of that. So, you know, just those really solid building blocks for our children and for ourselves, I'd love to see happen. Galway's already amazing. We don't know how we're going to cope in terms of how many people we're going to have to feed in 2020 and beyond. But, you know, and I think, you know, we need to be careful about how precious it is. Because, you know, sometimes, you know, people have been to Reykjavik and back in the day, and now Reykjavik, everybody's going to Reykjavik. So, you know, so it just keep it precious if we can. I think that's probably more important than anything, you know. And maintain the essence of it, you know, because it's beautiful.
Okay. What's ahead for you in 2017?
I thought you were going to ask this. I think it's for me right now, I'm just jumping in the sea in the winter, which I'm really enjoying, and I want to keep that going, and I want to slow down, and I want to get more life work balance. So I think that's something that is very important. I also would like to open a creative university with Mary Nally. I haven't talked to her about it yet, but I'm sure it's all fine. And working title is The Box Doesn't Even Exist. You know, so I'd like to do something like that, you know. I'd like to get involved in, you know, a different way of thinking. I think that weekends like this are really beneficial for people, and I think, you know, just engaging with people ourselves, it's a lovely thing, you know.
I think so. I mean, I think as well, like, weekends like this are really good because there's no real structure about them. You know, you just jump in, as you do with the sea every day. You just jump in and see where it takes you.
Exactly.
Cool. Yvan McNamara, thank you very much for joining us, Bander.
Thanks to Yvan for coming along to Dingle, and thanks to Banjo and Other Voices producer Molly King, and Salman, Stephen, Andrew Kelly, and all to Foxy Johns for their hospitality and help. The Bantercast series producer is Tanya White. More from Bantercast next week. Check out thisisbanter.com for more information about Banter. Check out othervoices.ie for more information about Other Voices. And sure, we'll see you next week.